I next met with Dr. Billy Liu, and to begin, he presented a 76-year-old man from his practice who had a small right upper lobe lung nodule discovered incidentally on a CT scan.
This is the most common presentation, of course, historically, of stage one lung cancer, is that it's asymptomatic, and the only way that most of these are picked up are incidentally. So that's something that we can get into a little bit in terms of, you know, the advent of CT screening and early detection for lung cancer now.
So at what point did you see him?
So I saw him after he had already gotten some recommendations, you know, in terms of treatment. The basic staging workup was done. And that's kind of the most common situation for me to see a patient is when the diagnosis has been made. Occasionally, I'll have an opportunity to participate in the workup as well. But as a radiation oncologist and patterns of referral, I typically see at least an initial staging workup. So in this case, that included a CT-guided biopsy of the tumor that demonstrated adenocarcinoma and a PET CT that showed no signs of distant metastatic disease or regional nodal disease.
So what happened to him?
So this was an elderly gentleman. He was reasonably fit in terms of good performance status, being able to handle all of his activities of daily living. At the same time, he had a history of COPD, emphysema. His pulmonary function tests were somewhat on the marginal side. So with more vigorous exertion and exercise, he would have dyspnea. And the most standard treatment for stage one lung cancer, of course, is surgical resection. It'd be a lobectomy. And he had been presented with that option, but felt to be somewhat high risk because of the poor pulmonary function and medical comorbidities.
He was a smoker?
He was a former smoker.
And any other specific comorbidities? Did he have heart disease or any other problems?
I believe he did have some coronary artery disease. That wasn't, you know, necessarily the most limiting thing. It was more pulmonary function.
And what was his background? What type of work had he done?
Like sort of, you know, office work.
Did he do a lot of research and have a lot of questions, or was he kind of just saying, what should I do?
Well, it was a little bit of both. I mean, he had done enough research to have heard about radiation as an alternative to surgery and wanted to explore that. Yeah.
That's interesting. And what were his thoughts and concerns?
His biggest concern was the potential recovery from surgery, the potential for a loss of lung function afterwards.
So what were your thoughts about him when you reviewed the case?
So at least by clinical staging, everything indicated that this was an early stage one lung cancer. And again, he was reasonably fit, but his pulmonary function was marginal. I believe he had an FEV1 that was about 50% or so of predicted, and similarly with his DLCO. So he's somebody that would have been considered at high risk, so not necessarily medically inoperable per se, but somebody that at least would be considered potentially for a sublobar resection rather than the standard lobectomy. So I think it was appropriate to consider potential alternatives, given that he was a candidate for what some might consider already a compromised treatment.
What did he end up having done? What did you recommend to him?
So certainly in the case of people who are outright medically inoperable, the standard of care has changed quite a bit in recent years. In the past, you know, we would have offered conventional radiation therapy. That would be small doses of fractionated radiation therapy given over a period of several weeks. And that has been an effective alternative, but certainly with results that are suboptimal, not as good as results with surgery, at least in terms of historical, you know, non-randomized comparisons. And of course, the main change that has come about in recent years is the advent of stereotactic ablative radiotherapy. And here we're able, with the technology, to localize the tumor and also to sharply focus the beam or the radiation field by coming in with many beams from different directions and keeping a very tight dose distribution on the tumor with much less dose spill out to the surrounding organs. We're able to give a much more intensive course of radiation safely. So now we can compress essentially a whole course of radiation therapy into a small number of treatments or even a single treatment and have a higher biologically effective dose that has achieved much higher rates of primary tumor control than conventional radiation has in the past.
What kinds of control rates have been observed?
So if you look across the series of studies that, and these are mostly retrospective, or now there are many more prospective phase two types of studies, the rates of primary tumor control have been in the range of 85 to 90%. And in fact, in the landmark RTOG-0236 study, that showed the highest primary tumor control rates reported so far of 98%.
So what happened with this man?
So he actually pretty much decided against surgery because, again, he really wanted the minimally invasive approach and did not want even a sublobar resection. So he was eligible for a clinical trial. It was an RTOG study that really was a dose optimization question. As I mentioned before, the landmark RTOG-0236 study looked at a very intensive regimen of 60 gray divided into three fractions, and that's actually the most intensive published regimen. This was a follow-up, a randomized phase two study to look at a single fraction of 34 gray versus 48 gray in four fractions. The idea being that the winner of either of those two would eventually go up against the more intensive regimen from RTOG-0236 in a randomized study. And he received a single fraction of 34 gray. And I last saw him in follow-up, I believe he's about 2 years out with no evidence of disease.
Any issues in terms of complications or side effects from his treatment?
Right. So he did have a complication, which was that this was a fairly peripheral tumor. And he developed several months after the treatment a rib fracture from after he was doing some work under his car. So he actually put a little bit of strain on the chest wall and developed a rib fracture pretty much right in the area adjacent to where the radiation treatment was given. And that caused him, you know, some mild pain that basically was managed by non-steroidal medications for a few months and subsequently resolved. And so that is probably, in fact, the most common side effect that we see for the more peripheral tumors is either chest wall pain that's generally pretty mild or rib fracture, which may or may not be symptomatic.
Other than the fracture, do you usually or did you and him see anything on imaging?
Yes, and that brings up a good point, which is in most cases, we do see some inflammatory changes surrounding the area of the target. And it's common to see on follow-up CT scans or PET scans. It manifests generally a few months after the treatment and may persist for quite a long time, although it evolves over time. And eventually you see sort of contracture of scar tissue and so on, and then some residual fibrosis. And almost always it's asymptomatic and not of clinical consequence, but it does often raise the question of tumor recurrence, or it's often interpreted as tumor recurrence when it's not. And so that's something to be aware of when working with diagnostic radiologists that may not be very familiar with the treatment. It takes some time for the diagnostic imagers to get used to the appearance of the post-treatment changes. So it's important not to, you know, overcall and leading to all sorts of invasive biopsies and so on.
So for the non-radiation physicist, can you explain to me why you use one dose?
So the whole issue is having adequate dose intensity to ablate the tumor. And if you look at the literature, you know, just because of the nature of how the technique developed, it sort of developed in parallel in many places. And so almost every study that you look at has a different dosing regimen. So there isn't one universal standard, and maybe there shouldn't be. One of the factors that has been found to be predictive of tumor control is the dose intensity expressed in terms of a biologically effective dose. So you know, there are a lot of nuances in terms of how do you actually, what formula do you use to calculate the biologically effective dose and so on. But the bottom line is that, at least in a crude sense, it is possible to compare different dosing regimens according to this conversion to a biologically effective dose And what's been found pretty consistently is that you need adequate biologically effective dose to achieve high rates of tumor control. And so that could be achieved in a single fraction. It could be achieved in a number of them. There have been a number of studies of this. At Stanford, we're doing a phase two study of what we refer to as individualized stereotactic ablative radiotherapy, where we adapt the dose and the number of fractions to both the volume of the tumor and the location. The idea being to optimize the balance between tumor ablation and normal tissue complications.
Let's talk about your second case, a 60-year-old man.
Sure. So this was a gentleman that was previously healthy and reasonably fit. And it was also an incidentally discovered cancer. His symptom was actually, well, it's not entirely incidentally discovered. He had a symptom of developing a pulmonary embolus. And as part of workup for that, was found to have a left lower lobe mass that on CT-guided biopsy demonstrated adenocarcinoma. His staging workup, including PET CT and MRI, showed a hypermetabolic mass in the left lower lobe, hilar and subcarinal nodes all non-bulky, and no distant metastases or brain metastases.
He was a smoker?
He was actually a non-smoker. So the staging workup showed no distant metastases or brain metastases. So by clinical staging, he was stage 3A.
So what were the alternatives that you think were reasonable in his situation, and what actually happened?
So the discussion for him was the role of surgery. And this is still a matter of some controversy for stage 3A. And most of us believe that there is a role for surgery, although the randomized data supporting that are essentially lacking. The criteria that we use to think about potential surgery for stage 3A would be nodal disease that's of minimal bulk, and particularly single station N2 disease, less than 3 centimeters, although there's a number of criteria that you could choose for deciding what constitutes bulky. But those are common ones that we think of here. And of course, physiologic fitness for going through a lobectomy. The other thing that I would say, and I think it's an important point, is that if we're considering surgery for stage 3 lung cancer, I like to know upfront that our surgeons feel that a lobectomy is doable from the get-go. So this is as opposed to saying, well, why don't we start in on chemo radiation? I'm not sure if it's going to be resectable. You know, after you get to 45 gray, we'll decide. And I think that the danger of that approach is that you get to that point and then you reevaluate, then the surgeon says, well, it doesn't look like it's responded well enough. I think we better pass on surgery. And then you've had a gap in treatment, you have treatment delays, and it's suboptimal treatment. So I think the important thing is to have a plan from the beginning that it's going to be a feasible approach, barring like progression on treatment and so on.
Where does testing for mutations fit in here? I know there's a trial being discussed, or maybe it's actually being launched, looking at sort of pre-treatment or initiating treatment with targeted therapy first in locally advanced disease. I was actually thinking about it for your first patient too, even though he was a smoker, you know, the idea of, you know, shrinking something down before you use radiation therapy.
Right. So for patients with certain genetic alterations, and the ones that we currently think about most are those with the EGFR activating mutations, or an ALK or a ROS1 translocation that have, you know, drugs now, erlotinib or crizotinib respectively, that have a track record of having a high rate of response in patients with those tumors. That becomes standard treatment now for patients with stage 4 disease. So the question is, what is the role of those agents in stage 3 disease? And of course, we don't have an answer on that yet. But as you alluded to, there is a trial that is actually about to activate. It's the RTOG 1306 study that is now basically an intergroup study with endorsement by Alliance and ECOG as well. So that is for stage 3A or B non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, in patients with either an EGFR activating mutation or an ALK translocation. And it's a randomization between standard therapy, which is upfront concurrent chemo radiation, versus induction with up to 12 weeks of either erlotinib or crizotinib based on the genetic alteration. And the goal is to see if we can improve the outcomes with the addition of the targeted agent. And potential ancillary benefits would be that by pre-shrinking the tumor, the toxicities of the treatment from, at least from the radiation and reduction of the bulk of the tumor, may be beneficial in terms of toxicity as well. So that's a pretty exciting study that is on the verge of launching now. It's been approved.
How would you feel about utilizing that strategy off protocol? You have a, you know, maybe an oncologist, radiation oncologist, who's the patient, very knowledgeable. He's been tested, has a mutation or translocation, and says, how about before you give me your chemo radiation, we shrink it down a little?
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I'd probably have a hard time recommending that off study with the current state of knowledge. I mean, there's a lot of potential unknowns there. You know, for one thing, the targeted agents are very good agents to have in your back pocket should the patient progress. And unfortunately, the nature of stage three lung cancer is that most will. So unless we can actually show that there's a better curative potential using that approach, I'm not sure that you want to kind of use up that ammunition up front. And the other thing is we just don't know. I mean, some patients, although a small minority, will not respond to the induction therapy, and then we may have compromised their standard of care.
So what happened with this man?
So in this particular case, actually, this brings up another interesting point, which is, you know, at the time that I see patients, they have had, I mentioned before, they've often had their staging evaluation done and so on. And by the time they see me, just based on patterns of referral and delays from insurance and et cetera, some time has passed. And so the staging workup that I see, you know, is often 4 to 6 weeks old. And so by the time I do our radiation planning, our simulation, the state of the disease may have changed. And so at my institution, what we do is we incorporate PET CT into the simulation process. And what we found is that a real advantage of that is that it really gives us the most up-to-date information that we're basing our radiation planning on. So in this particular case, we saw that on the treatment planning scan with PET CT, the nodal disease had progressed, and it was involving additional stations and was bulkier. And there was still no distant metastatic disease, but we did not feel that with that progression, he was an appropriate candidate for surgery. So the plan was to do definitive chemoradiation.
So what happened? How was he treated?
So he was treated with concurrent radiation with cisplatin and etoposide. And the other question that comes up is in the setting of definitive chemoradiation, at least from a radiation oncology standpoint, what's the appropriate dose of radiation to use? We know based on prior studies that there is a dose response to lung cancer. And between doses of 45 to 60 gray, the higher doses are more effective. So the question has been with, you know, modern radiation therapy that's planned with 3D planning, where we can get in higher doses of radiation without the same types of toxicities that we've seen historically, can we get more effective both tumor control and survival? And a number of phase two studies have shown that it's both feasible to give higher doses of 74 gray with concurrent chemotherapy and with promising results. So the RTOG, in collaboration with other groups, has completed the RTOG 0617 study. And that was a randomized trial comparing concurrent chemotherapy, carboplatin, and paclitaxel with radiation therapy given to the standard arm being 60 gray over 6 weeks, versus 74 gray in 7.5 weeks. And there was a secondary randomization to the addition of cetuximab or not. And the initial analysis of the dose question demonstrated no survival benefit to going to a higher dose of 74 gray. In fact, it seemed to be actually a little bit worse than the 60 gray arm. So that's kind of a challenge to understand that result and why we wouldn't be seeing improved outcomes with the higher dose of radiation. That's certainly kind of the a priori expectation based on some of the prior data that we would see that. So I think that's still an area of active analysis now. And I think one of the key points of that study, though, I mean, this was one of the studies where really modern radiation therapy with excellent quality assurance was used throughout the study. And I think the important result was that the 60 gray arm actually had better outcomes than seen in just about any other cooperative group trial, or certainly comparable to the best of them. And so I think that that indicates that the quality of the radiation therapy is very important and, you know, accounts for good results even with the standard dose of 60 gray.
I'm curious, of course, this was just presented at ASCO, what your thoughts are about why 60 gray was better, and particularly why it looked like there was better local control, which really didn't make too much sense to me.
Right. So that's really hard to understand, and I think that will require a lot of detailed analysis of the planning data and also the patterns of recurrence. So I don't think that that was a final analysis on local control. That was local control based on institutional reporting and not central review. And local control is actually a pretty hard parameter to score. And so I think at this point, I would say the jury is still out. I don't understand that result either, but I think we need to see how the analysis comes out.
Well, you know, I guess the other issue is the question of, you know, was there excess toxicity with a higher dose? I think the discussant of that paper brought up the possibility of sort of occult or, I don't know, subclinical cardiopulmonary complications. What do you think about that?
Right. Well, that would certainly be kind of the instinctive thought. With higher dose, certainly there's the potential for higher toxicity. Again, the preliminary analysis didn't seem to show a statistically significant increased toxicity. But then again, that's somewhat analysis dependent too. And there was a trend, though. So it could be related to toxicity. Again, one of the preliminary findings that is being followed up on, there was a suggestion that the dose to the heart was correlated with worse outcome and was higher, of course, in the higher dose arm. And so that'll be really a very interesting analysis to see.
I guess the other thing, and I think one of the questioners brought this up, is even though they couldn't, you know, bring in the cetuximab analysis, half the patients, I guess, got cetuximab. Could it be that they had more toxicity? And do you think there is more toxicity in your own clinical observations when you combine cetuximab with chemoradiation?
Right. Well, that's a great question. You know, I think it'll be very interesting to see how it comes out of the analysis. Just anecdotally from my own experience, I would say that my impression is that with cetuximab, there does seem to be a higher rate of esophagitis. And certainly, you know, we have much more experience with this in head and neck cancer, combining cetuximab with radiation. And it's certainly my impression that we see, you know, more mucositis and dermatitis, sometimes even compared to cisplatin. So I think that's going to be an interesting question, whether there's an interaction there that, you know, accounts for some of the results.
So what's the follow-up with this patient? What happened?
So he's still fairly early on in follow-up, but he actually had a very good initial response to chemoradiation. And coming back to the dose question, what did we give him? I gave him 66 gray, kind of an intermediate dose that compressed into a six-week schedule. So slightly accelerated based on our ability to, in this case, keep the dose compact enough to limit the esophagus, lung, and heart doses. And so for lack of data, that's kind of the empiric approach that I've been taking, is to try, rather than just pure dose escalation, to incorporate a little bit of acceleration when it's feasible on the basis of normal tissue doses. He tolerated the treatment very well.
What chemotherapy did he get?
It was cisplatin and etoposide.
And any side effects or complications? Did he have esophagitis?
Only mild, you know, it was managed medically.
Anything else you want to say about locally advanced disease? Any new data sets out there other than what you've mentioned?
There's a lot of interesting studies currently going on. So we talked about the EGFR and ALK alteration. But for the wild-type tumors, there's currently a study in ECOG looking at adjuvant therapy with a combination of a vaccine and bevacizumab. The RTOG is looking also at, again, rather than dose escalation, more individualized dose intensification. So the RTOG 1106 study is looking at the standard dose of 60 gray versus an individually adapted dose, also in a six-week schedule, but escalated based on both normal tissue limits as well as the response on PET partway through treatment. So that's an innovative approach where hopefully by individualization to the given patient, we can get more optimal radiation therapy. And then there is currently a phase two study of preoperative therapy. It's building on a prior experience of using higher dose radiation or full dose radiation to 60 gray in the preoperative setting. The current study is RTOG-0839, and that's testing the question in that setting of with or without panitumumab and whether that increases the rate of mediastinal nodal clearance.
Interesting. Let's finish out with your 64-year-old lady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a 64-year-old Asian woman, a never smoker, who has multiple ground glass opacities in both lungs. Now, this is a scenario that we're seeing pretty commonly now, at least in my geographical area here in the Bay Area in California, where there is, you know, a large population of Asians, and we're seeing more of these in never smokers, but not just in Asians either. So it's this phenomenon of multifocal adenocarcinoma or adenocarcinoma in situ. The terminology has recently changed. We used to call these bronchoalveolar carcinoma, and now that's been recategorized. But basically, it's a phenomenon that I think not everyone recognizes. And I sort of think of it as, you know, a field effect of precancerous lesions in the lung that, similar to actinic keratoses on the skin, they don't represent metastatic disease. They really represent multifocal early stage processes. And I think one of the challenges is recognizing this because there is nothing in the current staging system that these patients fall into. Technically, they could easily be categorized as stage four when biologically they're really not. So in any case, she had a history of these ground glass lesions in both lungs, multiple ones, almost all of which were stable over time, but two had evolved over serial scans and developed a hypermetabolism and solid components. And again, that's part of the natural history of these adenocarcinoma in situ ground glass lesions, that any one of them can evolve at different paces and start to develop more invasive adenocarcinoma features. And so she developed one of these in the right upper lobe and one in the left upper lobe, the larger one being in the right upper lobe. So the question is, how do you manage this situation? Okay. And again, I think of these as being separate primary processes. And the right upper lobe tumor was biopsied showing adenocarcinoma and no evidence of nodal disease or distant metastases. So one could argue that with now what looks like, if we consider that a stage one tumor in the right upper lobe, that that would be treated surgically with a lobectomy. And I think that would be certainly a reasonable approach to consider. But I would say also that in the situation where there are tumors that could develop into invasive cancers or one that's in the opposite lung that's very suspicious for being another one, whether to do an operation that affects a significant portion of the lung parenchyma is the optimal approach. And so I think there is no standard answer currently to this scenario, and you'll get different opinions. But this is a situation where I would think about less invasive approaches, possibly sublobar resection, but also I think there's a role for stereotactic radiation as well.
So what happened with her?
So in this case, she appeared to have two lesions, and based on a multidisciplinary consensus, the right upper lobe tumor was approachable by a sublobar resection. It was peripheral enough to reach. And so that was the treatment for the right upper lobe. And then the left upper lobe tumor was somewhat more centrally located, more difficult to use a sublobar resection approach. And we treated that with SABR.
So one final question I have to ask you. I see that one of your research interests is 4D multimodality imaging, and I'm real curious about what that is.
Sure. So I think that's another area where we've had a lot of advances in recent years in radiation therapy. You know, our task is to target tumors more and more focally and accurately, and yet we're faced with the problem of having to essentially shoot at moving targets. There's a lot of motion that goes on, and particularly with respiratory motion. And so we have technologies now, both with CT and other imaging modalities, such as PET and even MRI, of doing dynamic imaging. The most commonly available is what we refer to as 4D CT. And that's essentially a CT movie that we can acquire when we do our treatment planning. And there we can characterize the motion of tumors as the patient breathes, and then develop motion compensation, or what we refer to as motion management strategies. That can range anywhere from individually adjusting the radiation fields to cover the range of motion of the tumor if it's limited. If the motion is large, that strategy ends up giving radiation to a lot of unnecessary lung tissue. And so we'd like to be more precise than that. So we can do things like what we call respiratory gating. That's where we turn on the beam only at a certain portion of the breathing cycle so that we don't have to cover the entire motion trajectory. And the key is verifying at the time of radiation delivery that that's being done accurately. We also employ techniques here. We've developed biofeedback techniques. We show the patient their own breathing pattern so that they can hit certain breathing targets, either as a breath hold or in kind of voluntary free breathing, but hitting a certain level of breathing depth and turning on the beam only at the appropriate time, to tracking the tumor with the beam. So we can do all of those things now with our current technologies.
Where does the term 4D come from?
That refers to the fact that it's kind of the next step beyond 3D therapy, which was kind of the last revolution in radiation therapy, you know, having full spatial information to now having full spatial information and time. So that's the fourth dimension.
Final question. I'm kind of curious whether you have any perceptions about any myths or misperceptions in community physicians, either radiation oncologists or medical oncologists, about radiation therapy for lung cancer. Any, I'm not going to say mistakes, but things being done that maybe you don't agree with.
Sure. Well, I think I would say one of the most important things is, you know, it's more of an awareness issue, which is that historically, and I think probably it's still true, that if you take the entire population of patients with lung cancer, the majority of whom have metastatic disease, you know, the primary and perhaps most clinically impactful role of radiation therapy historically in lung cancer has been for palliative treatment. And that's a very important role that we have. But I think that that overshadows the realization that more and more we have potentially curative options for patients, including patients, for example, you know, one of the best current examples is patients who are medically inoperable, who can't have surgery for various reasons. We now have curative options for them that have outcomes that are starting to be comparable to surgery, you know, at least in non-randomized comparisons. And, you know, that's totally different from kind of the more nihilistic outlook in the past. And I think that feeds into the screening question too. The criteria that have been built into some of the screening studies, for example, age limits and so on, were predicated on, well, if these patients are not candidates for surgery, they really have no curative options, so it makes no sense to screen them. And that's really not true anymore. And so I think that's also an important realization.